What's up, Stitches? I'm Isabella Rosner, and if you don't know me by now, well then hello and welcome to So What. This is episode 13 of season 2, and we are back again with some historic needlework goodness. Today's episode is another fabulous interview, our third interview in a row, because why the heck not? We all love an interview, and there are so many people out there with such fascinating needlework expertise, why not spread those insights and that joy, right? The more needlework knowledge, the better. This episode's interview is with the equally fabulous Dr. Bethan Bide and Dr. Lucy Whitmore. We're getting into Jewish needlework. Finally! I'm personally very invested in this as someone who is 100% Jewish, but doesn't know a huge amount about Jewish stitching beyond some Torah bindings and schoolgirl samplers. Bethan and Lucy are in the midst of researching Jewish fashion making in 20th century London, the topic that is the focus of this episode. The discussion is not about traditional Jewish needlework like Torah bindings or wall hangings or matzah bags, but rather about Eastern European Jews who emigrated to London in the first half of the 20th century and the fashion networks they created. I am really super duper excited to learn about that, and I hope you are too. Dr. Bethan Bide is a lecturer in design and cultural theory at the University of Leeds. Her research, quote, centers around the cultural, social, and business histories of fashion. It focuses on material objects and explores how these can reveal historic relationships between production and consumption, the development of fashion cities, and the relationship between materiality, memory, and fashion as biography, end quote. Dr. Lucy Whitmore is a fashion curator at the Museum of London with a particular interest in the relationship between fashion and war and the capability of objects to tell stories of women's lives. She cares for a dress and textile collection spanning 6 centuries and 24,000 objects. Both Bethan and Lucy are co-conveners of the virtual Sartorial Society series. The duo's research focuses on clothing in the Museum of London collection, as it's where Bethan did a joint PhD and where Lucy now works as a curator. As always, images of what is discussed in this episode, as well as links, are up on the So What social media pages at So What Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and on the website sowhatpodcast.com. You know it, you love it, you're probably saying all of this along with me at this point, but I gotta say it. Anywho, let's get to the interview, shall we? Here it is. Thank you so much, Lucy and Bethan, for being here today. I am genuinely so excited to talk to you both.
It's great. I'm very excited.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. We love this podcast, so it's a real privilege to be on.
So how did you come to research and work with historic costume and textiles? And then how did you come to research Jewish fashion makers in London specifically?
My interest in all of this kicked off actually while I was a PhD student. So I was lucky enough that I received a collaborative doctoral award to fund my PhD, which meant that I could do my research embedded in the Museum of London. So one of my PhD supervisors was the fantastic Beatrice Balin, who's Lucy's colleague at the Museum of London. And I had 3 brilliant years of pottering around the collections there and getting to kind of work with the objects. And obviously it's a fantastic collection. It's really rich. But getting to spend time with those objects meant that I got to kind of really appreciate what you could learn from material things and really embed myself in that. So part of it comes from my love of that Museum of London collection. But a big part of it comes from the fact that the research I was doing, which was looking at the 40s, the more I kind of investigated the names and the businesses and, you know, did that kind of archival digging, the more I realized that a lot of these were associated with Jewish designers, Jewish workers, Jewish business owners. But that wasn't really recorded. That wasn't really associated with these garments. And it kind of made me think about the bigger picture about how we think about Jewish London and London fashion, and the fact that those things are actually very separate. And actually that's quite, it's not unique, but if we think about comparable fashion cities, that there has been a lot more research done about the connections between New York's Jewish community and its fashion industry. I mean, even in Paris, there's been a bit more work done about this. And actually, as a fashion city, I really felt that the contribution that London's Jewish community had made to building this fashion city just was really overlooked. So I think for me, I really wanted to know about how the networks of kind of Jewish communities, Jewish families, Jewish neighborhoods fitted into the broader networks that made London's fashion industry work.
My personal interest in kind of fashion and textile history, I guess it goes a long way back, but probably most noticeably when I did my undergrad degree in textile design. So I have a background in design and the creative part of the textile world. And right from the get-go, my design was always about telling stories. Like, I always wanted to tell stories in the things that I made. And then one day I realized you could flip that on its head and you could go back and look at things other people have made and find out what their stories were and share them. And that's where I felt my strengths really lay. So I did a master's and a PhD at the University of Glasgow in dress history. And all the way through, I focused on women's fashion in the First World War period. And what I realized was that this is a really intense period of history with like heightened emotional experience, and that dress can access that emotion and those stories in a really unique way that women's experiences of war weren't captured elsewhere. But loads of these stories have been lost. So I encountered, I worked with lots of museum collections and I'd find all these things from the First World War period, but they wouldn't have individual personal provenance. That was so unusual to find that. A big part of my research was saying, well, I know these stories are there. I know these connections between the outer world and the kind of individual emotional world are there. How do I find them? And so that led me down this route of thinking about the association between story and object, and what role that has in museum practice and the way we tell stories in museums. And whilst I was working on my PhD, Bethan was, I think, two years sort of ahead of me in her PhD process, and was very kind and generous with her time, actually, talking through some of my research ideas with me. And we found so many overlaps in our interest in kind of people and their world experience and themes like displacement and upheaval. And all of that really feeds into what we're working on now, because so much of the Jewish story is a story of upheaval. And Bethan has explained so eloquently why it's relevant to London as a fashion city. But I think it's worth mentioning that, I have my own personal connection to the project as well, which is that my great grandparents were Jewish, living in, they settled in what became kind of Vienna in Austria.
One of the things that really hooked me into this as a topic was thinking about the fact that actually a lot of people involved in the fashion industry sort of slightly concealed their Jewish identities, obviously at a time when anti-Semitism was absolutely rife. And I think I'm sort of fascinated by, Lucy, your family story kind of mirrors that a little bit.
Yeah, totally. So basically, my great grandfather who was called Max Moldau. So he was from a large Jewish family who were from kind of the Galicia area, came to Vienna, and at the very end of the 19th century, he set up a leather goods business, which became very successful, very well established. It was based in the kind of Neubau area, which is western Vienna. And it became very successful. They won awards, a sort of big trade exhibition in Paris. They were really well known for, so they did sporting goods and luggage. It was a really successful business. And it was because of his business connections that he was able to escape to the UK. He came first. My grandmother Trudy and her brother Heinz came over on, it wasn't the Kinder transport, but it was a similar kind of project to save Jewish children. So my Oma was 14 at the time. And then my great-grandmother Greta was left behind in Vienna to pack up the family house And she came over afterwards by herself, and she managed to save a huge number of possessions, really amazingly brought, you know, she brought furniture with her. They came over here and they found, they were disparate initially, they were all in different places, but came together and settled in Wimbledon in South London. And eventually he managed to re-establish the business here. So they were based in the East End and Holborn. And so that business ran here successfully until, I believe, the 70s.
What we want to highlight here is to point out the massive contribution, the skills, the business connections, all of those kind of things that London fashion benefited from massively.
So I know you're looking specifically at clothes made by Jewish people, but not necessarily for Jewish people. Could you please tell me more about the scope of your project and which makers you're looking at? And why is that period, the one that you're looking at from like the late 19th through the mid 20th centuries, so rich and interesting when it comes to Jewish fashion in London?
Great. Well, I'll take the first part of that question. So to give you a very brief sort of project in a nutshell summary, our aim is to look beyond some of the kind of tropes and stereotypes that have built up around the idea of Jewish people working in the clothing and textile trades in London. So most famously, and as kind of most significantly documented, Jewish people are associated with kind of sweated labor, the idea of sort of mass manufacture of clothing, in a positive way, in that they sort of revolutionized some of the way that kind of mid-market clothing is made, but also there are negative tropes there as well. And they're mostly associated with tailoring. And, you know, we are aware that Jewish people had involvement way beyond that kind of small, narrow example. You know, Jewish people are working in high-end, in bespoke, in women's wear, in the production of accessories. So we want to look at the extent of the Jewish contribution to London's fashion industry, focusing on case studies of some of those types of designers, so women's wear and bespoke largely, both kind of at the kind of dressmaker level and including high-end as well. To understand why this contribution has been overlooked, or maybe not, is just not recognised as much as it should be, and to kind of go beyond some of those stereotypes, look at individual stories, understand the networks that were formed between Jewish makers, the skills that they developed, where those skills came from. And then the kind of second component of our project is asking why this isn't as present as it should be within museum collections of dress. So in the Museum of London collection, which we've, for obvious reasons, used thus far as our kind of case study, there are numerous examples of really brilliant women's wear made by Jewish people. But the Jewish story has not necessarily been documented. Or if it has, there is no kind of level of detail. And that means that at the moment, or thus far, those objects aren't usable in the setting of a museum to tell a really rich and nuanced Jewish story. And it's so important that museums tell stories of kind of all of the communities that they represent. So looking back at the collections, at how we can enhance that documentation and tell better stories is really important to us. So we're starting with the Museum of London, but we hope that this project will enhance any dress collection that contains Jewish made objects.
I like this sort of start with the Museum of London and then the world.
That is the power you have. Oh my goodness.
Well, and I think it's about also a lot of our perspective about kind of knowledge sharing. That, you know, that's something that's really important to this project, that actually this project is about working with lots of people and sort of, you know, that's communities, that's other curators. And again, that's really important for, I think, this project and thinking about whose stories we're telling. So in terms of thinking about the sort of second part of what you asked there, this time period is really interesting, both in terms of London's Jewish population, and it's really interesting in terms of London's development as a fashion city. And those two things, although, you know, we all know causation does not necessarily relate to, you know, the correlation and causation are not necessarily the same, but the hypothesis is there's a relationship between mm-hmm. those two factors. So there are sort of two big periods of Jewish migration that fall within the scope of where we're looking. So sort of the end of the 19th century, start of the 20th century, big movement, you know, very well historically documented, big movement of Eastern European Jewish people to the UK, often onto America, North America as well. And what is quite interesting about this is it ends quite suddenly. And this is something that the business historian Andrew Godley has written about a little bit. And he talks about the fact that one of the things that's really interesting and quite specific about why Jewish people may have been able to develop within the garment industry in the way they did is because the combination of the First World War and various government legislation stopping immigration routes mean that you kind of stem the flow of new immigrants who are very useful in terms of taking on low-skilled, low-paid jobs. So actually, you sort of allow the people who are here to become more established and to develop more established businesses within garment making. So there's a kind of really interesting opportunity there. And that is bolstered and added to by a sort of second wave of migration in the 1930s. You have a lot of Jewish people fleeing Nazi Germany. And as Lucy's family's examples show, a lot of those people have established businesses, which some transplant, some don't, but a lot of them come and start new businesses with the knowledge, with the connections that they already have. So again, there's a kind of second big boost of immigration. So those sort of demographic waves are really interesting. And that ties into, I said, what's going on with London as a fashion city, which is London is negotiating its global status as a fashion city during this time period. London, obviously, is there's quite a long history there. It's got a couple of hundred years of London is a centre for fashion, but it's not Paris.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But ready-to-wear comes along and sort of shakes stuff up a little bit, because although we think of New York as kind of, you know, the centre of ready-to-wear, actually London does an awful lot of really interesting stuff in terms of higher-end ready-to-wear. So a lot of actually those Jewish-owned, Jewish-run businesses that are founded in the 1910s, 1920s, develop as places that sell good quality, well-designed, particularly women's wear. So there is this kind of developing idea that London actually could be also a design centre that is intimately connected to the development of ready-to-wear. And this is something that fashion historians like Liz Tregenza have been looking into with their kind of explorations of sort of wholesale couture and that kind of level of the market. So that is, I said, I personally think is all, I think those two things are connected, but I think it makes it a really exciting time because you are seeing the idea of London as a fashion centre really coming into its own. You're seeing kind of that negotiation of the fact that not only can we be important nationally, we could be important internationally, we can be a fashion design centre, we can be a global powerhouse. And that is enabled by a lot of the people who are involved in the fashion industry who have Jewish backgrounds. So there is a kind of really interesting connection there.
Where did these Jewish dressmakers learn their skills? And if I can ask another question within that, what was the role of needlework in these Jewish and non-Jewish institutions and networks in which they learned their skills?
So I will kind of kick off with the about where are we learning these skills? And the answer is all over the place, basically. And that is a range of kind of quite informal and also more formal education. So primarily, you know, first and foremost, at home, as I have sort of mentioned a little bit, there are a lot of people, particularly women, doing piecework at home, but also a lot of kind of journeyman tailors who are also working at home as well. So it is reasonably common to have a family member who is working in the garment industry at home. So you are kind of observing these skills, and you're often actually also perhaps being asked to kind of help out with little tasks. You know, you're kind of learning on the job. So there's a huge amount of kind of community transmission of skills going on there. There's also a lot of on-the-job training. We've managed to kind of find lots of evidence of family members who go to work in someone else's workroom and then go off and start their own business or go into a related business. So there's obviously a lot of kind of, you know, slightly older teenagers, young adults who are learning it through kind of familial community networks, getting job experience, work experience and learning skills there. But there are also formal training opportunities. Perhaps sort of most significantly at London's trade schools. So these are kind of not Jewish institutions, but we have found there are some really quite interesting connections between the Jewish community and these institutions. Taking two in particular, you've got Barrett Street Trade School, which is in the West End. It's where the London College of Fashion now is. It sort of grew in to become the London College of Fashion. So if that gives you a kind of geographical area. And the Shoreditch College for the Garment Trades, which also later formed part of the London College of Fashion, but is kind of over on Curtin Lane over in Shoreditch. So we can see from enrolment records that they both had quite a large number of Jewish pupils, but we also can see that there's a lot of kind of community encouragement for people to enrol. So for example, we can see that there are community leaders in places like Jewish girls clubs who are facilitating students knowing about these courses, getting students onto these courses. And we also see that these institutions are quite heavily supported by Jewish members of the fashion industry. So the consultative committees for a lot of these courses and these institutions are comprised by prominent Jewish members of the fashion industry who are also then supporting people getting jobs out of it. So it's really interesting, I think, for me to see that there is both kind of, you know, sort of fairly close kind of community networks. So your mum, your mum's friend are going to help you get a job. But actually also there are these kind of more formal networks that are connected to, you know, the London County Council's network of trade schools. So I think it's really interesting to see the diversity within those options.
Totally. Love that. Thank you.
I think, like Bethan says, it's what we do know is that I suppose girls and boys are learning sewing and kind of allied skills in lots of different contexts. And one kind of, I guess it's sort of a rabbit hole, it's become a bit of an obsession, is looking back at Jewish specific organizations that from, you know, mostly schools that are kind of likely to be the first places that these skills are sort of formalized. And looking at the way needlework kind of fits into their curriculums is really interesting. And it's not necessarily hugely different to the way these skills are being taught to Christian or other non-Jewish children in London and in the UK more widely, because every girl was taught to sew at some point for a very long time, as you well know, Isabella. Yeah. but I think looking at a kind of some narratives within Jewish schooling in London can tell us a lot. So in, you know, pre-19th century, there wasn't a huge provision of schooling for Jewish children. And, you know, schooling wasn't compulsory for anybody. And it was very likely that poorer children, and that includes poorer Jewish children, were not going to be given any kind of formalized education that was provided for them, unless it was sort of sought out or the family had money to pay for it. And this left some children quite vulnerable, and there was a arguably horrendous Christian missionary movement in the 19th century to convert Jewish people to Christianity. And in London, there was an organisation called the London Society for Promoting Christianity amongst the Jews. And this was part of a wider national movement, and they set up three schools in London in the early 19th century. I think it was between 1806 and 1813. And two of those were the Hebrew girls' school and the Hebrew boys' school based at Palestine Place in Bethnal Green. There's a whole compound dedicated to converting Jewish adults and children to Christianity. And the schools operated by essentially bribing parents. They offered their children an education, food, clothing, and they were keeping them off the streets. And sometimes they would even pay the parents in order to do this. And you can imagine that, you know, the Jewish community was very upset, to say the least, about this movement, and encouraged parents not to send their children, but some did. And you can, I think, understand why. It was an opportunity for their children. I mean, not huge numbers took it up, but they did. And both at these schools and elsewhere in the UK, needlework was always a part of the missionary activity. So both for children and for adults. That school triggered the Jewish community in a way into action. You know, the provision of schooling, the need for provision of schooling was already recognised, but I think these schools helped motivate the community into organising. So then you get Jewish voluntary schools, such as the Jews Free School, which was a hugely successful project. It actually really starts in the 18th century, but it grows and grows and grows through the 19th century. And by 1900, it is not only the biggest school in London, not only the biggest school in the UK, but the biggest school in Europe. It had over 4,000 pupils in 1900. And it was an incredibly successful school. They had a very famous, very long-standing head teacher who was incredibly dedicated to the Jewish youth and to education and to getting young Jewish children into careers, essentially. And that school took very different approaches to educating boys and girls in the 19th century. So it's interesting to note that boys were often apprenticed, and the tailoring trade was by far the most popular choice for male apprentices. And the girls' curriculum was very much focused on preparing them for domestic life. So that included sewing skills. So they were taught plain and ornamental needlework, dressmaking, hemming, sewing, marking, you know, for laundry, knitting. And then the constant question mark for me, which is herringboning, which I am yet to decide whether is a reference to the herringbone stitch or to the action of boning fish. And that requires a little more digging on my part to find out which one it is. And I think just to kind of finish off that the sexism here, the girls had to clean their schoolrooms, but the boys did not, as part of their duties. And early on in the girls' education at JFS, members of the public, presumably the Jewish community, would bring them pieces of needlework to work on to help with their education as practice. But I think people started to abuse the service. So the school recognised this and actually started charging people. So they had a price list for all of the different kind of sewing, household sewing that you might need doing, and then the girls were doing this service as part of their education, which is fascinating. It just shows how embedded sewing was within their education. The one other institution or organisation that I wanted to mention here is a subject that has become very quickly very close to my heart, and honestly I'm just waiting for the film adaptation of the story to come out. So it's Lily Montague's West Central Jewish Girls Club. So Lily Montague was from a very, very, very wealthy Anglo-Jewish family. She was one of 10 children. And she sort of slightly defied the expectations of what she would do with her life by committing herself to the sort of charitable work that supported working class Jewish girls in the West End of London. And she, when she was, I think, very young, I think she was about 18, when her sister and her cousin set up this club, and it was there to support Jewish girls who were school leavers, so sort of 12, 13, 14, who were working probably full time, but were not yet sort of marrying. And the idea was to give them a safe and appropriate place to spend their free time when they were outside of work. But she also was quite, I think, really a forward-thinking person, and she wanted to give these girls a chance to develop themselves socially, culturally, spiritually, and to potentially give them skills that could help them either get into a different trade than the one that they were working as a young school leaver, or to just expand their horizons more generally. So she ran a huge program, hundreds of different evening classes that you could sign up to. And in 1914, I've seen a list of the different classes available, and they're kind of divided up. So there's physical education, there's spiritual options, there's sort of things for fun, and then there are things for self-development. She even included sex education, which I think is a really interesting.
Yes, Lily.
But the 1914 curriculum included blouse making, which is really interesting because we know a lot of Jewish people worked in blouse manufacture, which was a really early stalwart of the kind of mass manufacture of women's clothing. Needlework, lace making, knitting, and artificial flower making. So that's just a few examples. So I think that helps us understand all of the different spheres in which Jewish women in this instance could gain skills, and just how varied those skills could be as well. It's so much more than just mass manufacture or just tailoring.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's sort of about the range of skills that are involved in doing that as well, is that kind of thing of actually, you know, even when we find people who've gone on to work in kind of mass manufacture, actually with a bit of training, suddenly you're doing the pattern cutting. Suddenly, you know, it's the more kind of training you have, the more skills you have, the better a job you get working on this, the more creative a job you have, the more you can kind of really make something of yourself in this industry. So I think it's really interesting to see that being recognized and to see kind of communities and institutions figuring out how you help people upskill so they can do that.
I love it. I had no idea about any of this. Like, my mind is blown in the best way possible. I have embarrassingly never heard of the Jewish Free School.
I was about to say, you can still, the Westminster one, you still can walk past. It's sort of tucked behind Oxford Street.
So I hear from you both that you are focusing on the work of two women, which I love to see. Can you tell me more about the women, their work, and where you think they learned their skills?
Absolutely. So I guess I should preface this with, we're looking at various case studies from kind of across the fashion trades. And that does include some men. We are allowing men to be a part of this project. We're interested in any kind of Jewish people who are engaged in kind of the aspects of fashion making in London that kind of fit the remit of our project. But there are two women who've become really prominent in our research. And that is partly because their stories are so fascinating, but it is also because we access them through objects, and those are kind of some rich collections of objects that have come to us. So the first person is Peggy Lewis, and Peggy Lewis is represented in the Museum of London collection by a group of garments that were actually worn by her sister, Anne Marcus. And those have been in the Museum of London collection for a while. They predate my time working at the museum. And they are such an interesting family. So Peggy and Anne's maiden name was Nagley. Their parents came to London in the late 19th century from Latvia. And every member of the Nagley family worked somewhere in London's fashion and textile trade. Peggy herself, Peggy Lewis, is a dressmaker. She's based on Whitfield Street in the West End. And she is doing bespoke women's wear to quite a high standard. And we have two ensembles made by her in the Museum of London collection. So one of them is a black sort of cocktail suit from the early 50s with some lovely sort of black beaded trim. And the other is a real show-stopping dress. So both of these were made by Peggy for her sister Anne. And the dress is early 50s. It's an amazing sort of olivey green silk satin with this incredible embellishment. And looking at those garments can tell us quite a lot about Peggy's skill and the way she operated. She started as a dressmaker in the 20s. We don't believe that she had any formal training beyond presumably some of the types of training that we discussed just now. But she started out by making clothing for kind of acquaintances and friends of the family. And then she managed to establish her business in the 1930s. And she was based at that site until the 60s, the late 60s. So she was, you know, she was pretty successful. She employed around 15 to 20 people in her workroom. She clearly specialised in embroidery. The East End is more commonly associated with the Jewish community, but there was a very important and thriving Jewish community in the West End as well. So her placement there is also quite interesting and significant because she's doing bespoke, she's doing, to a degree, it's luxury. And the East End is more commonly associated with things that are kind of a bit more mass manufactured or produced a little less expensively. So that's an interesting contrast as well. The other person is Sophie Rabin. So Sophie was born Sophia Neshwa, and she comes from an area that is now Poland called Juzesa. No, I don't think I can say it.
That's okay.
Juzesów nad Wisła.
Oh, that sounded really good.
I think that's it. So she comes to London in 1914 with her family. Her father is also some kind of a cloth merchant. And they were incredibly poor and they suffered real persecution. So they managed to come to London through his sales of cloth that he sold around the world. And they planned to go on to either Canada or America. But they come to London in 1914. As Beth had mentioned earlier, the First World War kind of puts a pause on some of these migration patterns. So they end up staying here. Sophie she didn't speak any English. She arrives in London. She has 2 years of schooling. And we don't know where she went to school, but we know that she did well, that she learned English in those 2 years. And her granddaughter very kindly donated a group of those garments to the Museum of London just at the very end of 2019. So we have two evening gowns that she made for herself, and we can see from those that she has real bespoke skills because they're very much personalised and customised. And in fact, she makes matching evening bags, and one of them has a little S embroidered on it for Sophie. So they're lovely things. We also have a blouse, which is really interesting because that's where she started her career. And we imagine that she was really trained on the job in that field. A beautiful pair of shorts, which I'm very fond of, simply because we have the most glorious photo of her wearing them with a matching bikini top on the beach. And they give us a kind of a sense of her taste and her personality, which is really nice. So these are two stories of two individual women who were very skilled, and there are lots of gaps in these stories, which we are hoping to fill. But there's all sorts of small details that might not seem hugely significant, like the fact that Sophie got a prize for drawing in school. But actually, when we start to kind of compare those snippets of stories with what we do know about Jewish networks and Jewish education, you can see why how we start to flesh things out and kind of contextualize them.
How does looking at other case studies based on archival research help fill in gaps in stories based around objects where we have no written records or oral histories? Because it mm-hmm. seems like in the case of Peggy and Sophie, there is quite a lot of information there, but I can imagine that's not necessarily the case in many other situations.
Absolutely. And it's something that as fashion historians, I think we struggle with a lot. I know that something that's shared across people who work with kind of fashion and textile objects is often the stories of the people who made them have never been considered really worth recording. So things have perhaps been kept because they're kind of beautiful decorative objects, or they've been kept because they are associated with somebody famous or important who wore them. But actually, there's often a huge gap, even when we have things that are relatively well documented. There's often a huge gap in terms of actually, who are the other people involved in this? What are the other stories that are missing? And particularly with the 20th century fashion industry, it's a real issue because a lot of businesses and manufacturers purposefully concealed a lot of those details because they weren't particularly glamorous. So, you know, when you're trying to kind of hunt down addresses, when you're trying to kind of hunt down, actually, even where was this factory and who was there, you'll find that kind of the letterhead doesn't correspond to the business directory, doesn't correspond to the tax record, because, you know what, the address where they were actually making things over in the East End is not as glamorous as the address of the showroom in the West End. You know, there's a lot of kind of fashion is an image industry, so there's a lot of kind of purposeful concealment of elements. So there is a really interesting question, I think, when you're researching fashion objects about kind of how much can you speculate? How much can you fill in the gaps? Where are you going to find that contextual information from? Because we're never going to know for sure. But we've been able to kind of join together some of the individual things we've been looking at. So some of the individual institutions, some of the individual businesses, through connections in other archival sources. So one of the richest of these has been a oral history interview that was conducted by the British Library as part of their kind of millennium project with a woman called Lily Silberberg, who just absolutely fantastic woman. You know, when you listen to her recording, she's just absolutely no nonsense. Here is a woman who has been very successful in the fashion industry. She's had a great career. She absolutely knows her mind and she's got a lot to say about it. You know, she's one of those people, you listen to her voice and you just think, God, I'd love to go to the pub with you. And sort of, you know, I want to hear the sort of the real stuff behind this. But so she kind of has this really great evocative oral history interview where she talks about how she got into the fashion industry. And she was born to Polish and Russian Jewish parents. And again, she's one of those really interesting examples because her family lived as secular, but she was very heavily involved in Jewish community groups. That's where she's socializing. So it's again, that really interesting question we keep coming up against about what's it mean to be Jewish in London? Is it about practicing faith? Is it about community? And it's a bit of all of these things. So she's a really, you know, she's one of those people who, again, she offers us some really interesting nuggets in lots of different ways. But she also comes from a long family of people involved in the garment trade. So her grandfather's a tailor. Her father's a journeyman tailor. Her mother is a buttonhole hand. Her family members are also all doing piecework. So she's got this really strong connection with the garment industry. And she then goes to train at Barrett Street Trade School. From there, she goes on to work in various workrooms. She becomes a pattern cutter. She becomes, I mean, essentially, she's doing a lot of design work, quite happy in the industry. And she then actually goes back to work for Barrett Street, which then becomes London College of Fashion, as a teacher. So, you know, she's really got this kind of fantastic story of really coming from a very, very poor immigrant family, right at the bottom of the fashion industry, to sort of rising through it very successfully. And so it's a kind of wonderful story anyway. But so the fragments she gives us about the different institutions she's connected to, the different family networks, the different community networks, the different business networks and how those operate have been so helpful for us to imagine how these different pieces of information we've been able to collect about different objects and different Jewish groups work together in the fashion industry. So that is really, really interesting, even though she's one example. So obviously one individual is never going to be representative, but she does give us real interesting clues about how these networks might work. And there's also been other places we've been able to kind of eke out this sort of information. So one of my favorite places to look has been in the social records of the London branch of the Garment Workers Union. So trade union social records are brilliant because you kind of get this really rare glimpse of garment workers. You know, these people who have kind of really not been recorded for history, the faces behind the pattern cutters, the manufacturers. And what's really great about their social records is you get a glimpse of them as people. You get a glimpse of their skills and their desires. You get a glimpse of actually their creativity. So there's fantastic photos of people who are wearing garments that look really like they're homemade. They don't look like anything I've seen for sale in shops around a similar time. You know, they're very stylish, very kind of dramatic. And you think, this is fantastic. You're, you know, working all day, perhaps making ready-to-wear outfits, and actually you're using those skills to create these kind of fantastic social outfits.
What is each of your favorite needleworked object or objects?
So staying on theme for this project,
the
objects that I think I think about the most and I am the most moved by is a sampler. It's from 1838. It is a royal sampler, so it says long live our gracious Queen Victoria, and then it has some sort of religious verse. It has the date May 24th 1838, so just a month before Victoria's coronation, and it is edged with a green fringe, which we actually think may be arsenic, so it is currently very carefully packaged in the dress. And then in the bottom right corner is stitched the address, Hebrew Girls School, Palestine Place, Bethnal Green. So this is from the school that I discussed earlier. And I think it is such a powerful object because it's visual evidence of one of those girls who went through this process of coming from a Jewish family, probably being quite poor, and then going into this environment where she was, where people attempted to convert her to a different faith. And whether or not they were successful in this instance, we don't know. I don't know the name of the girl that made this, and I haven't yet got to the level of research where I'm looking at records that might give me names of any of the girls that attended the school. But it's so powerful as a representation of that, you know, deeply anti-Semitic moment, which sadly was not an isolated moment, but it was one of a chain of moments in London's history, in Britain's history. And I think it's also really interesting that the royal connection is incredibly interesting, because patriotism was seen to be a fundamental aspect of any Jewish child's education. So whether they were in a Christian missionary school or in a Jewish school, such as the Jews Free School, those schools in particular really, really, really emphasized the kind of Anglo aspect of the education, and teaching the children to be British citizens or English citizens, as well as being Jewish in those instances, was really, really important.
So I think my object is similarly fascinated with the sort of human. So I'm going to pick the dress that Lucy mentioned earlier, made by Peggy Lewis, which is this sort of fantastic floor length, sort of greeny silk dress. And it was made for her sister Anne. And I love it for many, many different reasons. The first of those is the fact that it is a fabulous outfit, incredibly glamorous. So it's not just that it's this kind of gorgeous full silk dress, but it is very, very heavily beaded. And it's this beading that's kind of, it borrows a lot of, sort of Jacobean themes in the design of the beading. But the beading is kind of very brightly colored. You've got loads of great pinks and purples. And you could really see, like, you would walk into a room in this and you would own the room.
Oh, yeah.
And what is amazing about that is, the person who wore it had it made for a wedding, not her own wedding, a wedding she was a guest at. So talk about upstaging the bride. You can imagine just this moment of walking into a wedding wearing the most fabulous, enormous, ornate beaded dress. And I kind of love that sense of the personality you get of Anne. You know, we kind of can see from pictures, I mean, she's a flamboyant dresser, but you get a real sense of kind of her confidence and her enjoyment of life that comes out of this. But I'm a really big fan of looking on the inside of clothes as well. I love what we learn when we kind of flip things inside out. And it's a very different dress from the inside than the outside. So from the inside, it is quite unfinished. You know, from a kind of a dress that is that nicely cut and that detailed on the outside, you would normally expect to be much more carefully finished on the inside. And in that, I get a real sense of the relationship between these sisters, you know, that Peggy is making a dress for her sister. Her sister doesn't need it to look beautiful on the inside. Her sister doesn't mind about that. It doesn't matter if we cut those corners. So I kind of love, I love the personality that comes across in the design, but I love actually the personality that comes across in the stitching and the relationship between these two people that comes across in the way that this garment has been made. Absolutely. It's so rich for me.
What do you think the role of needlework is in today's world?
So I'm going to, I think, start off by thinking about the role of kind of historic needlework and how we consume that, how we see that, how we think about that. Because I think that's something that's been something me and Lucy have talked about a lot and something that's really important to us. And it touches on something that Lucy mentioned about the idea of kind of the importance of recording people whose histories weren't recorded, and particularly in relation to fashion and garment industry, that tends to be women, it tends to be immigrant women. There's a very strong and long history of that. So one of the things that I know we both really believe that looking at historic needlework can do is it does help us tell those stories, and it helps us tell those stories in a way that isn't just generic and stereotyped, because it helps you kind of see the person underneath it, right? You know, when you look at stitching, you can evoke not just kind of the skills and the training and the experience somebody had, you can also evoke a sense of kind of how rushed they were, how busy they were, what kind of environment that, you know, this stitching was being done under. There's an enormous amount of information you can get from this material output that somebody has left behind. And I think that is something that's been so important to us, is that kind of close looking at that at those historic marks that somebody has made with a needle and thread, and what that has meant and what impact that has had.
Bethan has just put that like so beautifully. There's not a huge amount else to say on that subject, because you've just summarized it perfectly. But I think it's a really good reminder that needlework is so emotional and emotive and sympathetic, and it can be an incredibly engaging way to communicate with people who may not have a pre-existing interest in needlework and maybe from a very different background to yourself. And you know, when we have people come and visit the museum and particularly come into the stores and look at needleworked objects, they can be really, really moved by them and sometimes quite surprised by how moved they have been by them. And they open conversations that have amazing contemporary relevance. In terms of making in the present day, if you spend your time like we do thinking about this historically, it's very hard not to feel the weight on your shoulders in a nice way of all the people that went before you with that trade, and to connect back historically. So whether that's embroidery and you're connecting to Girls Who Make Samplers, or it's dressmaking and you're connecting to Jewish dressmakers, it's a way of connecting to past generations and to continue telling their stories and then bringing your own story into it as well.
And finally, the last question, how can people learn more about both of your work? Do either of you / both of you have anything you'd like to promote? Tell me everything. I want to be your hype woman. I want to know it all.
Well, the first thing to mention, a project that Bethan and I have been working on throughout the pandemic, and has honestly been a true joy, alongside our colleagues Liz Tregenza, Liz Gernard, and Serena Dyer, is the Sartorial Society, which is an online series of dress and textile history talks. And when this comes out, we will be just wrapping up our second series of talks, which take place on a Thursday evening. And there will be another series coming soon. Do take a look at our website, which is
sartorialsocietyseries.com. And actually, if you have a look at that website, you will also be able to see a talk that Lucy and I have given about this project as well. So you can catch up on a little bit more about this project too.
How relevant.
Uh-huh. And of course, you can check us both out on Twitter.
So the other thing that might be of interest to your listeners is a series that we made at the Museum of London called London's Fashion Alphabet. And it was a behind the scenes dive in with us to our dress and textile collection, which we started before the pandemic, but there's actually been a really nice thing to be able to share whilst we're all missing museum and museum stores. And there's one episode that may be of interest, which is O, for Otto Lucas, because Otto Lucas made two hats that belonged to Anne Marcus, Peggy Lewis's sister.
Amazing.
And general style icon. So if you want to see a little bit more about Anne, then check out that episode.
Thank you so much. This has been amazing. I've learned an incredible amount. So thank you.
Well, thank you for letting us celebrate these, especially all the fantastic women we've been able to celebrate. I think that's been wonderful. It's always wonderful to chat about the fantastic women.
Absolutely. It's just like an honor to be able to share these stories.
Yay, interview! Yay, Jewish needlework! Ugh, what a treat. I learned so much in this interview, and I honestly really hope you did too. It's the lengthiest interview on the podcast yet, but there is just so much to learn and information to share, and the more knowledge, the merrier. This discussion of Jewish needlework makes me think a lot about my own family's connection to fashion and textiles. Like a lot of Jewish immigrants in the US, they were involved in fashion. My grandfather's family had a women's clothing store in Boulder, Colorado for decades, so Lucy and Bethan's work feels very personal. But I also think it brings up really fascinating questions about connections between religious minorities and the cloth trade in both London and beyond, which is something I think about a lot in my research on Quakers, who were very, very actively involved in the cloth trade and who, like the Jewish fashion makers Lucy and Bethan research, lived and worked in East London. That's something Bethan, Lucy, and I talked about quite a bit because we all find it very mysterious, but we talked for over 2 hours and that didn't make the final cut into the episode. The connection between religion, cloth, and geography is fascinating, and I really hope someone is out there looking into the connection between certain religious groups and textiles in major European and American cities. If no one is, I'm going to get into it because I am very keen. Now that my personal ramble is over, may I just say what an absolute treat it is to get into new topics on this podcast. Ugh, Jewish needlework in the 20th century. The world of needlework is so broad and wide, and there's always more to research and discover. What a glorious thing, constantly delving into and learning about and loving needlework from a wide variety of places and time periods. There is so much to learn, and that's really thrilling to me, and I'm assuming it is to you too. Love this for us! And that is it from me this week. I will see you next week for more historic needlework goodness. Thank you to Lucy and Bethan so much for the wonderful interview, and thank you to you all for listening. Now go out and stitch some stories and figure out if herringbone meant the stitch or literally deboning a fish. Bye! Thank you.